we're on to 2021.
Cats, better than 1917.
You are a Criterion charlatan.
Armando, I'm canceling your cancel.
This Taylor Swift Netflix documentary is a straight-up masterpiece.
You only watched 32 films this year. The Letterboxd Mafia is not pleased.
This is one of the year's best films, and it's buried inside the Netflix algorithm.
What is it about Shia LaBeouf's artistic expression that you find so threatening?
Did he seriously watch Richard Jewell, or is this a troll?
My taste just happened to be off the beaten path.
This one is on multiple streaming services. You have no excuse.
Justice for Lupita, justice for Gerwig.
Dumont is inescapable. Coin is undeniable.
Are you feeling this? Are you feeling the way I'm feeling right now?
What's up, everybody? You're listening to a Third Act Podcast bonus episode. I'm your host, Christian Estabrook, and I am here with Jericho Serrano. Jericho, how you doing?
Christian,
yeah.
You are my favorite new to me of 2021.
That means the world to me. No Armando today. This is a me and Jericho thing. This is you and I, my friend. Mm-hmm. You are the Trinity to my Neo. Actually, No, you're probably the Neo to my Trinity. Right? I don't know. Quick nod to our previous episode, listener, where we talked about The Matrix 4. But this is you and I. I think this is the third time we've done this, right? Where we run down just the tippy top five old films we watched for the first time in that year. And I look forward to it. It's not a lock that we'll do it. You know, it's the end of the year. There's a lot going on. But every time we manage to do this, I'm a huge fan of it.
I am as well. And I think most years are new to me's, all the films that are new to us end up having more of a lasting impact than the new releases.
Sure.
A lot of these films end up being classics or favorites of all times. I mean, often we'll see things that completely shake the foundation of our cinematic lives. And when's the last time that happened with a new release film?
Not too often. I mean, the top one or two films of most years I consider to be pretty special. But yeah, I mean, it's a tall order to say, hey, this one year, this new year, you got to do something that really wows me. Whereas if you're looking at old movies, you got, 100 plus years to go back and find some hidden gems, some buried treasure, maybe check off some cues of shame, some big blind spots that you've always meant to get to, or maybe stumble upon something you never even heard of and take a chance on it and becomes one of your new favorites. So what was the journey like for you? I mean, I can lead the witness here and say, I know you took a little bit of a break from watching movies altogether in 2021. Mm-hmm. And what brought you back was old movies. You spent a lot of time going through some classics, some movies from many decades ago, and that's what kind of got you back into rhythm. So what was your year with old film like altogether?
Yeah, it was a pretty weird year overall, I guess, from the standpoint of any sort of media consumption. I mean, I started off the year, I was watching things, and for my own physical and mental health, I took a break just because of some health conditions, had to. And I wasn't really watching much at all. But when I started to get back into that flow of watching films again, I started kind of looking at certain eras that I wasn't too well versed in. So I started going into the 50s. I started going into the 30s and watching things from genres that, such as melodrama or romantic comedies, things that, you know, I've seen fair share of, but not to this length. And that's kind of what got me back, because I think it's just the calmness of these films, the relative simplicity of many of them, even if they're great. With all that noise in my brain, I needed that to kind of get me back. And then, you know, from there, I just kind of took off and slowly, as my health improved, started watching, kind of expanding my palette, as it were. But yeah, that initially early in the year, and a lot of my picks on my top 25, top 10, even my top five were things I watched during that period. So I think it was really kind of, I don't want to say movies saved my life or anything, because that it's not true, but they definitely helped me kind of find my footing again and just help me through some challenging times. So I'm pretty excited about this list, and I'm sure, Christian, you are doing at least a top 10, maybe a top 25 letterbox list. Am I correct here that you're going to be dropping this soon?
You are correct. Top 25 is locked in. I plan to have it go live on Letterboxd the same day that this episode will release on New Year's Eve. So I will post that there as well. So we'll talk about top five today. But, I mean, there's some heavy hitters. I don't know. I'm trying to think this year, did I, you know, usually I talk about, I've capped off this, you know, major filmmaker's filmography, or I did the certain run. I think it was a little bit different of a year than that. I didn't do anything like finish off a Scorsese or Robert Altman or anything like that that I've done in years past, but still had a big focus on watching as many old films as I could. I watched 142 new to me films in 2021. And there's some big blind spots, some major movies. I can give you a tease for the rest of the list that we won't be talking about. I watched things like Amadeus, Hellraiser, the first Wachowski movie, my Flixmas gift, Hi Mom, a bunch of movies that were pretty major in my mind before having watched them, finally got them checked off the list and left a big impression on me. So another successful year watching old films. And I think we always have to evoke on these new to me episodes our friend Ian the Minister, who coined the phrase, new films drool, old films rule. That's kind of the energy that we're trying to live in on these best new to me films. So top 25 locked in. We'll talk about the top five tonight. What do you have? Do you have a top 25 as well, or a top 10? Did you make a bigger list as well?
Yeah. So normally how I do it with my site, Symbiotic Reviews, is I do a top 10 with some honorable mentions. Usually the honorable mentions are everything after the top 10. But on Letterboxd, I'll have a top 25. I'll have a top 10 plus honorable mentions on my site. So that's kind of how I go about it, just because I'm not going to – I don't want to write blurbs about 25 movies, you know. So that's kind of how I do it there. But if you want the full list, that will be Letterboxd. And on my site will just be the top 10. So – and that's going to be rock – that's going to be dropping – I mean, it will be out before this episode is live. So that will be out in the ether and the internet. But yeah, in terms of total films, I watched 107.
Nice.
So not too bad behind you a bit, but, I did stop in this last 2 months watching older films to try to catch up with new stuff. So I'm sure that total would have been much higher in a year where I didn't take 7 months off. So, still pretty good.
It's a good year. So let's get into these top fives here.
Yeah.
Jericho, why don't you start things off? Number five, new to me for 2021. What have you got?
Number five is Johnny Guitar from 1954. And stars Joan Crawford. She's a proto-feminist icon in this subversive Technicolor Western directed by Nicholas Ray, which is about a lot of things, and entire essays have been written by smarter people than me about its many layers and its many readings. But the most obvious takeaway from this thing is that it's a critique of McCarthyism and the Hollywood blacklist. So if that's of interest to anyone, this movie really gets into that. But it's never preachy in its messaging. The colors pop. Crawford, of course, crushes. And the film, it can be seen as a lot of things. I mean, you can look at it as revisionist, as you can look at it as camp, as many people do, Or you could just say it's a hell of a good story, well told, with great performances and a kind of interesting critique on McCarthyism of the era. So that's my number five, a great film, something that's been on my, I guess, my queue of shame for a while. Johnny Guitar, 1954.
Johnny Guitar. I like it. We talked a little bit about Nicholas Ray here on the podcast this year. Mm-hmm. I've got some Joan Crawford on my list. There's a little tease mm-hmm. for you as well. So I love it. I'm not familiar with this film, but I love it nonetheless. Will you love my first pick? I don't know. I teased you off mic. I feel like my list is a little absurd. I feel like this collection of films doesn't make any sense together, except for the only through line for these films is that I loved them. Other than that, they have no business being related to one another in any way, shape, or form.
No caveats. And, you love what you love.
Yeah. Even in this moment, I'm checking myself. Is this really top five new to me? Could it be? Like, there's so many heavy hitters below this movie on my list. But I'm starting off with a 1980s comedy? Are you kidding me? Of course.
I think I know what it is.
It can only be Midnight Run.
Uh-huh.
An instant classic for me. Armando, our dear friend who's not with us today, had name-checked this one for me a few times going way back. Going like 7-8 years back, I remember he name-dropped this one. For whatever reason, it just did not ever pique my interest. 80s comedy, you know, buddy comedy, two dudes. I'm like, is this going to be Lethal Weapon? I having no idea what it was. I also know there's a movie called Cannonball Run, which I believe is a disaster. Like Midnight Run, okay, Robert De Niro, Charles, like, I don't know. It never grabbed me. It's from the director of Beverly Hills Cop. I haven't watched that since I was a kid. I was like, does that movie hold up? Maybe it's probably going to be dated. There's probably going to be all this kind of humor that doesn't play anymore. I don't know. For whatever reason, I had all these reasons to never check it out. And then I finally watched Midnight Run, and I already said it, instant classic. It's got to be the best purely comedic performance from Robert De Niro. Maybe I'm cheating a little bit because there's a lot of drama in The King of Comedy, even though the comedy's in the title. But if you take that off the board, this is De Niro doing pure comedy. For those who aren't familiar, he plays a bounty hunter. He's sent to find the accountant for the mafia who's skipped bail and is now on the run. And Robert De Niro is tasked with going out to find him. And if he does, he'll get a big payday. That accountant that he's tracking down is played by Charles Grodin, who has become, I think I may have mentioned this when we did our Clifford episode. He has become one of my favorite comedians ever. So much so I feel like I just need to watch everything that he did. We talked about him as well when we did the Ida Lupino series. We talked about the Heartbreak Kid. I think he's incredible in that. And he is just an absolute knockout here. And it is not the movie's not it's not quiet, it's not small or anything like that. This is a big broad comedy, but the funniest elements of it are in the moments. They're in the looks. It's really in the comedic timing, especially Charles Grodin. The pauses that he takes before following up with something Robert De Niro says, the questions he asks. There's a scene that should not be a standout at all, but he's at a diner and he's asking how much a cup of coffee is compared to a cup of tea. And like, I had to pause it the first time I watched it just because I was laughing so hard. Like, I can't even connect the dots and tell, you know, the listeners what it is about this that makes it so funny, except for Charles Grodin's facial expressions and his timing, I think, is just absolutely perfect. So a movie I honestly never would have expected to love this much. Like, you wouldn't have to convince me much that, oh yeah, you'll like this movie when you finally give it a chance. But the fact that this is an instant classic, one of my favorite comedies of all time, Could not have seen that coming, but Midnight Run is incredible. I think it's streaming on like Netflix now or whatever. If anyone hasn't seen this, you gotta watch Midnight Run. It's so, so good.
All right. So number four for me.
Yes, sir.
Is My Man Godfrey from 1936.
Oh, yeah. Great movie.
I think I mentioned this once on the show and I recently watched months ago. But this is a comedy masterpiece from director Gregory LaCava. And it follows this homeless man who's played by the wonderful William Powell. And this plot is basically he's offered $5 by this rich socialite to be taken to a scavenger party and then gawked at as a forgotten man by all these rich assholes. And what this movie is basically a class conscious satire where the character of Godfrey, played by William Powell, essentially becomes the wealthy family's butler. And he outclasses them all, including a flighty woman played by the irresistible Carol Lombard, who actually pops up quite a few times on my list later. You know, I won't talk about her again today, but other films I watched this year with her. She is a great discovery for me, even though I've seen her in things. But anyways, this one, My Man Godfrey, I mean, Christian, you've mentioned emotional film going this year for you. This, for me, is the real deal. This is the one that brought me back. A tearjerker that's never manipulative. It's emotionally powerful, but it's never maudlin or really just, you know, going for that manipulative kind of thing. It's also really funny and very intelligently written. So if you like your comedies with a little bit of an edge, with a little bit of class satire going on, but also with just a sweetness and a sentimentality that's not sickly, that really works, then I say, you know, go for My Man Godfrey. Probably the best butler movie ever made. Better than Lee Daniels, the butler.
Nice. Love it. Great pick. So for my number four, I swear I'm going to live up to how chaotic I said this list is.
I'm bracing.
Is this a more out there pick than Midnight Run? Maybe. I'd never seen this before. Iconic. At least one image is certainly iconic. I'd seen it, known it, film class, all that. But never actually sat down and watched this film. It's actually a short film. It's only 13 minutes long, I believe. You can watch it on YouTube. I believe it's still on the Criterion channel. Jericho, we're going back to 1902 for Georges Méliès' A Trip to the Moon.
Whoa.
Maybe the first ever science fiction film. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I get it. They go to the moon, the spaceship smashes into the moon. The moon has a face and it has like the drippy blood or whatever it is on the moon. We all know it. We've all seen it.
Yeah, I've seen how those Smashing Pumpkins videos, you know.
how could you really be wowed by this in the year of our Lord 2021? And I got to say, I actually sat down, watched the start to finish. I watched the color version. There's color black and white. The color was it's not like a colorized thing like when they did It's a Wonderful Life and they did this like gross color on it. But even back in the day, they would take frame by frame and hand paint each individual one. And it is just a marvel to see what science fiction was like well over 100 years ago, how they interpreted, you know, well before any of this was thought to be possible, how they would interpret sending people up into space, what that would be like, the clothes that they would wear to go to space, just the expression and the way that this type of story was illustrated. really, really hit me watching this for the first time. So yeah, it's kind of an obvious pick. It's like if I was sitting here talking about like, hey guys, have you ever heard of Citizen Kane? It's pretty great. But I don't know, sometimes the obvious pick is the right pick. And you go back to one of the earliest films, this guy, Georges Méliès, made like hundreds and hundreds of short films. This is definitely his most recognizable. I didn't do a deep dive or anything like that. But watch it. Spend less than 15 minutes watching this short. If you haven't seen it, if it's been a long time or you haven't seen the entire thing, all perfectly understandable. But if you actually just take this in as a film experience, I think you'll be surprised at how rewarding it is to watch this, the way a science fiction story was told turn of a couple of centuries ago now. I was just really pleasantly surprised by watching A Trip to the Moon, and it stuck with me all year. It's my number four, new to me.
Fantastic. So moving on.
Number three.
Yeah, number three, we're gonna flash forward about 20 years or so from your pick. 23 film here.
Yeah.
Safety Last! Directed by silent era star Harold Lloyd. Harold Lloyd. I mean, he's often overlooked as silent film stars go, you know, especially with Chaplin and Keaton kind of being put above him. But I think he more than solidifies his case as a genius with this astonishing film, in which he plays this everyman who's trying to make it in the big city. Probably the most famous shot, and you may have seen the still, is Lloyd dangling from an oversized clock on a 12-story building in downtown Los Angeles. Sure. That's the ending, you know, that the big, huge set piece at the end takes place on the clock, and it's incredible, of course. But there's set pieces throughout this thing, pratfall, stunts, also slapstick, and lots of bits of business where Lloyd is doing his trademark shtick, you know, the guy tailored with the suit, with the glasses, very resourceful, the go-getter. He's attempting to chase the American dream. And very much like Chaplin's Modern Times, this film is ultimately about the anxieties of modern living, but it's fucking hilarious, and it's incredible in terms of just these like set pieces are jaw-dropping. And you know, I've seen quite a few Chaplin, I've seen quite a few Keaton. I've only seen, I think, one other Harold Lloyd, so this was something that I just really wanted to dive into, just because he's one of those guys, you know, and there's a reason why his name is mentioned in the same breath as Chaplin and Keaton, but he doesn't seem to get quite the praise as those guys. And I think, you know, maybe he doesn't have the filmography or the catalog, like especially like Chaplin does. But if you're going to see one, I mean, I haven't seen a lot, so I can't say. But I think this is easily a masterpiece. Safety Last, 1923. Harold Lloyd, check it out.
Fantastic. How about we stay in the 1920s, Jericho?
Oh, man.
How about we talk about another silent film? Mm-hmm. Featuring some just bangers, directed by Todd Browning. We're talking about 1927's The Unknown, a early horror film starring Lon Chaney Sr., which people will know if you're a fan of genre silent films. He was in early versions of The Phantom of the Opera and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, both incredible films. And this one also stars an early performance from Joan Crawford. It is about a man in the circus who is armless and is an acrobat and is also involved in some other kind of nefarious things that unfold over some pretty major plot twists over what's just about an hour long film, just over 60 minutes. There is some of it that has been lost to time. So some of the second half, or I think it's from the second half, is lost at this point. So we don't have the full film that's survived as of now. But you have an absolutely incredible performance from Lon Chaney Sr. in this. He was an incredibly expressive actor in the silent era. He was nicknamed the Man of a Thousand Faces. So he was known for how well he could contort and manipulate and express himself without the use of his voice in these early films. And he plays a man who just, you know, double amputee, does not have either of his arms. And he convincingly, and it can't be the case, but it seems effortless, his ability to perform without arms and then use his feet as if they were arms. He will pick things up with his toes. He will, in a moment where he's thinking, where he's being pensive, he will rest his chin rather than on his fist, on his foot. And he is able to do one of the most impressive physical performances I've ever seen. Literally, like that, I'm being hyperbolic, but I think it's earned here. He is incredibly convincing. The movie, I'm being a little bit vague because, to be honest, this movie's 95, 96 years old, whatever it is. But there's twists in it that are quite shocking and surprising. And I don't want to spoil it, which seems absurd for a 100-year-old silent film. But I hope more people check out The Unknown from a storytelling perspective, from a creepy horror perspective, from a performance perspective. This is an absolute banger. It was something that truly wowed me the first time I watched it, and then enraged me because I can't believe that more people don't know of and talk about The Unknown. I think it's criminal that this film is not in the Criterion Collection. I hope that there's restorations. I mean, getting some of that lost footage back would be incredible, but whatever's out there restored, get us on the Criterion Channel, get us some baby blues of The Unknown. This one's really hard, really, really hard to track down. One of the most difficult ones to track down there is, but if you can find The Unknown, find it by whatever means necessary. You know, I'm not telling you to do anything illegal, but if you can get your hands on The Unknown, please watch it. It is an absolutely incredible film. My third favorite new to me from 2021.
All right. The Unknown, jotting that down. I have not seen that. Yes, sir. That. I will be on the lookout. All right. Number two.
Getting serious.
Yeah. Jumping ahead a few decades here, more than a few. And we're going to 1964 now. The film called Nothing But a Man. It's directed by Michael Romer, who also incidentally directed another film I loved from this year from the 90s called The Plot Against Harry, which I think I mentioned on a previous episode. But this small, underseen gem from 1964, I think is on another level. It's a deeply personal film that has a naturalistic feel. It's the perfect answer to a lot of the more slickly made race relations movies of the time, starring guys like Sidney Poitier. And it follows a black rail worker who's drifting through his life. He falls in love with a young school teacher, and it just hangs with these people. There's not a lot of plot. There's no huge melodramatic scenes. It feels like watching a novel. It's the story evolves naturally, slowly, and the way race is handled here is also very honest. It's weird. It's like a sweet, gentle movie that also involves racism and discrimination. It simply examines the day-to-day of these characters, their lives, and I think it's all the more emotionally resonant because of that. So, you know, this is a movie directed by like a French white guy about black characters in the 60s. And it's shot in black and white. And it's just an astounding little film. And also another one like Christian, your pick, The Unknown, that is very difficult to track down. Also, I think that this should be part of either the Criterion Collection or Kino Lorber. Someone should really restore this thing because I think it's a pretty important film, especially for its time, and all the more important because it's not shouting from a rooftop about how important it is. It's just a really intimate character study slice of life kind of a film. So, but I was very moved by it. I was kind of blown away by its simplicity. And it's called Nothing But a Man from 1964.
Excellent. Love it. So let's go to my newest film on my list. This is an obvious one. This is one that no one will be surprised is high on my list. If you learned I watched it for the first time in 2021, this is a classic from someone who just turns out certified classics all the time. I'm talking about Hayao Miyazaki's Howl's Moving Castle.
Here we go.
Which I saw for the first time in 2021, which, yes, I am a bit ashamed.
Wow.
And I was working to round out any blind spots there. I think I'm down to one left. I have not seen Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. I believe I've seen the rest of his films. And, I mean, with Miyazaki, it's pretty much a given. It's just a kind of a done deal that any of his films are going to be transportive and imaginative and impeccable from technique and from an artistic perspective. And they're pretty much all great. Maybe one of, if not the highest batting averages of any directors, especially in the modern era, just turns out incredible work after incredible work. So this isn't quite Spirited Away for me, which is my favorite of his, which, you know, it's not quite as rich, doesn't have quite the simple brilliance of My Neighbor Totoro, which I also love, but this is way up there. I adore this movie. And I think in particular, the design is what I haven't been able to get out of my head since watching this. My Letterboxd review at the time was, is there anything in any movie as well designed as the titular castle in Howl's Moving Castle? It is a marvel. Every shot of this big, overflowing, life-encompassing structure that moves around from place to place, it is just a marvel every single time. It is, even looking at stills, which I'm doing right now on my IMDb, just seeing not even the moving pictures, just a shot of this is thrilling. So, you know, from someone who just, you know, seems to turn out masterpiece after masterpiece, somehow I had avoided Howl's Moving Castle until this year, and that was a mistake. This is an incredible film, an obvious pick. For anyone who I told I watched this for the first time, of course it would be high on my new-to-me list, and it is. It's number two. Howl's Moving Castle, an absolutely incredible film.
Yeah. Well, the shocking thing about that is, yeah, it had been unseen.
Yep.
By you.
Big mistake.
Rectified. So now yep. We're number one.
Number
favorite
one.
Favorite new to me old film. Jumping ahead now in the early 70s. And who do we got here? You're talking about Miyazaki. I'm going to talk about another titan of cinema with Rainer Werner Fassbinder.
Okay.
8 hours don't make a day, which is his 8-hour family epic commissioned by German public television. It is appointment binge viewing.
It's really 8 hours long?
Yeah, it's 5 episodes. So it's a TV series, essentially. It's the best old film I saw in 2021. It's the best old TV series I saw in 2021. It's also the rare Fassbinder joint where the bleakness is more subtly integrated and where the characters aren't all raging, self-destructive assholes. I think this is Fassbinder's attempt at a family-friendly sitcom, but it does have political activism. It has a lot of interpersonal relationships with different characters. And there's a shadow of fascism that's like hovering over the series with a left-wing vision of conservatives who eventually become liberal because their lives go to shit. So, yeah, I mean, this thing is sprawling. It mostly centers on this young toolmaker, the women he loves, his eccentric family. And it really is startling how political this is for a TV series. And even if Fassbender reins in some of his bolder flourishes, the overlapping dialogue, the long scenes that are just play out, the deliberate ways that it's kind of filmed, it completely immersed me in this world. I wanted to spend even more time, even more than 8 hours with these people. Plus, we get a treasure trove of Fassbender regulars and key roles here, all the favorites, because I've seen a lot of his movies. So these character actors, these people that pop up, his roving band of thespians are all here. It's melodrama. It's kitchen sink realism. It's playful. It's political. And it's fucking great. So if you have 8 hours, which you do have 8 hours in a day, you should use those 8 hours to watch 8 hours Don't Make a Day from 1972. This was actually, for a while, it was not readily available, but now it is Criterion came to the rescue here. It is on the Criterion channel, I believe, or at least it was when I watched it. Things kind of come and go from there, but it is in the Criterion collection now, so it's easily accessible. It is not an entry point to Fassbender, I'll say that. It's not, I wouldn't recommend it to someone that's not, hasn't seen a Fassbender or a lot of his stuff. So more for the diehards, but for me, I think it was the only Fassbender film I watched. Well, I watched another film that where he was in, where Fassbender was a starring in it, but I guess it wasn't directed by him. So the only directed thing I saw from him in 2021 is easily the best thing I saw. So that should tell you something. So number one, 1972, 8 hours, Don't Make a Day.
Love it. Great title. Love that title. 8 hours, Don't Make a Day.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. All right, Jericho, you might know where we're going. Faithful listeners, if you haven't missed an episode of the Third Act podcast, you also might know where we're going.
Oh, yeah. Jazz drumming here. We need some.
need a little drum.
Let me get my heroin
piano.
Here out of the drawer.
Of course, my favorite new to me film of 2021 is from 1961. It's Shirley Clarke's The Connection. We talked about this. I don't even remember. What was it? A pairing film? Is that what we did? Why did we even talk about this on the podcast?
Yeah, I chose it. It was a pairing. I can't remember what our release
was. I don't even remember what we paired it with. I can't remember either. But whatever it was, I'm sure it overshadowed it because this one absolutely blew me away. It's the first film I'd seen by director Shirley Clarke. And if you don't remember, you missed that episode. This is it's a early mockumentary where.
Oh, here Shirley we go. Clarke, sorry. Yeah. You're at episode 171, One Night in Miami.
Oh, wow. This was way back. This must have been, was that January, February?
First episode of we did. It was the first episode we recorded after our best of.
Wow.
Episode.
Look at that. Some staying power there. yeah. So so this is Shirley Clarke. It's a mockumentary. She cast a, you know, quote unquote director of this film. It's presented as a documentary of a group of men, about 10 of them or so. It all takes place in one apartment. It's an adaptation of a play where they're just sitting in this kind of dingy studio New York apartment in the 60s. Most of them are jazz musicians, and they're hanging out, waiting for their next fix. And the drug dealer comes in at one point. They get their fix, and then you see kind of the fallout of that in the last act of the film. But I'm kind of shocked and amazed that this is a adaptation of a play, because it seems so well suited as a film. I think the language that Shirley Clarke uses to tell this story is groundbreaking and revelatory. I'm just blown away by how she was able to tell this story. I watched this for the first time in preparation for the show. My wife was out getting groceries or running errands, something like that. She came in right as I finished it, and I was just like spouting off, oh, this happened, but it's a documentary. And then, oh, and then the director is in front of the camera. There's this drug dealer named Cowboy. He comes in with Sister Salvation, doesn't even know any of them are doing drugs. And I'm just like going 100 miles an hour, just blown away by this movie. And then I watched it again with her. I watched it twice before I even reviewed it. And that's what cemented this as a five banger. This is an easy five star from me. And it's another one similar to The Unknown that I mentioned, kind of ping ponging here from obvious picks to, you know, really picks you really have to dig deep to find. This is not one that's been talked about very much. It is streaming on the Criterion Channel, or at least the last I checked, but this was mostly kind of buried at the time. It was hardly released. It never made its budget of $167,000 back at the box office, mostly because it was controversial. It was one of the first movies to use the word shit in it. And in this context, they refer to the heroin that they were using as shit. So just the language was too offensive for distributors or audiences or theaters at the time, let alone the fact that it shows these men in deep and heavy heroin use. So the content, the form, the filmmaking, so much about this really blew me away. I haven't stopped thinking about it since I watched it way back near the beginning of the year, apparently. Watched it a couple of times, and that only cemented how much I loved the connection. And I'll keep saying it. I'll keep repeating it. I'll keep bringing it up in hopes that more people check it out, because it is without a doubt the best thing, new, old, whatever, that I saw for the first time in 2021, TV, movies, whatever. The Connection was the kind of seminal first time watch for me in 2021. I loved it. Hope more people check it out. It's an amazing, amazing film.
It is great. And spoiler alert, it does make my top 25.
Hell yeah.
It's outside the top 10, but yeah, it's something. It's something. And I'm glad that we were able to have a full conversation about it as well. So anybody, if this piques your interest, go back. Episode 171. Hear us talk about One Night in Miami and The Connection. That was just a two banger, too, with me and you, I believe.
Yep. Yeah, I was just about to bring that up. I know Armando's busy. He's got to get to the PTA and things like that. But we gotta pin Armando down and make him watch The Connection. I'd love to hear his.
I think he watched it at the time. Because he was going to be on the episode, but something happened, scheduling conflict. So I think he had watched it, but just never weighed in. Yeah. So I could be wrong about that, but I remember him mentioning that. I think he liked it. I definitely was not over the moon like yourself. So. We'll pick his brain next time. Are we gonna ever talk to him again? I don't know.
We hope to. Jericho, good list, good year, good episode. I mean, this is not just mine, but you know, between both of us looking at the spread here, we got a lot. We covered a lot of corners. We're going back to the 1900s, the 19-aughts. Mm-hmm. All the way up more than 100 years on the list. We got a 13-minute film and an 8-hour film, different genres. We covered a lot.
Yeah, nothing earlier than the 80s, right? I mean, it was all 80s and before that, correct?
Yeah, well, Howl's Moving Castle, 2004. Yeah.
That's one. That's a modern one. Everything else was. I was thinking, man, we didn't even get into the 80s or we didn't even get into the 90s or the aughts, but Miyazaki, he'll do that.
Got fuck the Miyazaki it up. He'll in fuck there, up but the yeah, a couple of silent films. I loved it. And this is why it's fun. You really can't get this much variety if you're only talking about new release films. We can't cover this much ground in terms of genre, in terms of length, in terms of types of films, silent films, you know, different types of foreign films based on what's available. I don't think you can get this eclectic of a crop of films if you're only talking about new releases. That's why we like to highlight the old ones as often as we can.
Yep. And listeners, tell us your favorite nudies. Yeah. Hit us up on Twitter. We don't have Instagram, but email, call on the show, the voicemail line. I don't know. How do people?
We don't have a voicemail line. The Third Act Podcast at gmail.com, Facebook and Twitter. Maybe I should make a letter, not a letterbox, a Instagram for us finally. People use that more than Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook sucks. I never go on Facebook. But yeah, let us know what's on your new to me if you'd like. No judgments. You can put an 80s comedy on there. You can put something that you definitely should have seen before 2021 on there. You can put a TV show on there. Whatever. We welcome.
No judgments. Posy vibes only. All love.
So that's going to do it for 2021 for our new to me list. But we're not quite done with the year yet. Coming up for the next couple of episodes, most likely we'll be starting our roundup, our wind down, however you want to call it. We're going to finish up talking about 2021. We'll talk about some more lists. I don't know if we're going to cram from here. We got to talk about some licorice pizza. We're not going to eat the licorice pizza, but we got to talk about it at some point. In a couple of weeks, you should be hearing us talk about our favorites from 2021. So stay tuned for that. Jericho, it's been a blast.
Yep. Thanks, Christian. And we're on to 2022.
All right. Listeners, remember that the greatest act of all is the third act of the rest of our lives. Make the best of it and have a good night.